Hello, you. This is the podcast of BBC Inside Science from the BBC, first broadcast on the 6th of November 2014. And I'm Adam Rutherford. Terms and conditions at bbc.co.uk/radio4. We investigate an utterly pointless way of injecting drugs. By that, I mean the needles have no actual point. It's bonfire season, so we visit the scientists whose job it is to set fire to things, which includes, rather upsettingly, jelly babies. And we have the curious tale of Dr. Stronzo Bestiali. We take a shadowy flight into the world of phantom scientists who serve to expose scams, injustice and the academic sense of humour. It's all part of the strange world of academic authorship. And one of my favourite stories, which is just for you, dear podcast faithful, is the way that Imperial College biologists Hassell and May determined the order in which their names would be presented in their 1974 study entitled Aggregation of Predators and Insect Parasites and its Effect on Stability. A footnote on the first page highlights their very British strategy. It says, the order of authorship was determined from a 25-game croquet series held at Imperial College Field Station during summer 1973. But first, one of the great unspoken crises we face as the 21st century unfolds is that Europe is rapidly growing grey. In 1900, the global average life expectancy was 31. Today, it's 70. And the number of people over 85 in the UK is predicted to double in the next 20 years. We all know what getting old feels like, but from a scientific point of view, do we know what is happening to our bodies, to our cells? One definition of ageing is simply the increased chance of dying the longer you live. Now, if that sounds like a tautology, there are some organisms whose chance of death does not increase the longer they live, as Professor of Biological Gerontology Richard Farragher explained.
Have you ever had clam chowder?
I certainly have, in Boston.
Congratulations, you've eaten what's probably a non-ageing organism, the quahog Arctica islandica.
Right.
Some of these animals are so old that Shakespeare could have had them in a bowl of stew.
All right, then. So what is it? If we are organisms that do age and certain types of delicious clams are organisms that don't, what is going on in our cells that is different from the clam?
Interesting question to which we don't have a full answer. A more interesting one is, why does ageing exist? Because that provides you a partial answer. Why does ageing exist? Because if you look at organisms in the wild, even ones which don't die from inside, the longer they're around in the wild, the more likely they are to get killed off. And then if you let those animals reproduce, which is what they'll normally do, you always get more offspring from the young cohort than from the old cohort. And this has a flashy biological name, which is the force of natural selection declines with age. Because all natural selection measures is number of offspring. So there is, under normal circumstances, very strong selection pressure for any mutation that makes you a better replicator early on in your life course, even if that's associated with bad stuff later on. This also has a flashy name. It's called antagonistic pleiotropy. And we think that aging is just the accumulation, the deleterious side effects of selection for early reproductive success. So that's why aging exists.
So does that mean that old age is effectively merely a byproduct of youth?
Old age is a byproduct of selection for what we call early life fecundity, for reproductive efficiency.
That's a bit noggin-scrambling, but I want to get to the real mechanics of it, how we understand the actual processes that are happening in our bodies and more specifically in our genes and in our cells. In those sort of terms, how does ageing work?
It seems that there are two major mechanisms causing ageing in mammals. One of them appears to be based on the ability of cells to sense nutrients. The other is based on the accumulation in tissue of things we call senescent cells. Senescent cells exist because there's a need to protect the body against cancer. After a set number of divisions, these cells won't divide anymore, and they do bad stuff. Nutrient sensing appears to be important because if a cell thinks it doesn't have any nutrients, it recycles damaged components and clears out the junk. And these converge on a key protein called TOR. And so basically, TOR is the protein within cells that allows cells to see if they have nutrients or not. The mutants that show extended lifespans are mutant in the pathway leading to TOR, which means their cells think they don't have any nutrients. As a result, the cell is forced to recycle damaged components much more effectively, we think, because it simply thinks it doesn't have any new material coming in. An analogy that works for me, I'm a father, I have a 10-year-old son who loves Lego, is it's the difference between your son getting new Lego every week in a box and building the models and having to take the models he's already built apart to make new things. Obviously, it's much easier from my son's point of view to get endless new boxes of Lego. But if the boxes of Lego stop coming, maybe because his father is tired of bits of them going up the Hoover, then if he wants to make anything new, he has to break stuff down. And that's energetically more costly than just getting stuff in new.
No, I share your son's pain with that.
Yeah. So that's nutrient sensing. We know that's right because there's a compound called rapamycin, which, if you administer it to animals, mimics the effect of these mutants. The animals live much longer because they are much healthier. And this is incredibly hopeful because people are already using rapamycin in preclinical trials to improve things like immune function.
So we're beginning to really understand the mechanisms of ageing and what ageing is, and as you've explained why it exists, does this mean that we're getting to the stage where we might be able to give treatments, give something like an immortality pill where we can give maybe something like rapamycin to people and they will just live much longer?
Immortality pills are going to stay in science fiction, I'm sorry. We are already at the stage where our knowledge of the mechanisms of ageing, which I think we need to think of as what they really are, which is health maintenance mechanisms, is being used to improve later life health and could be used in dramatic ways going forward. Many of the most respected gerontologists in the world have said that rapamycin would form potentially an effective treatment for mild cognitive impairment, an early state that you're in before many people move towards Alzheimer's disease. I think that's an incredible potential for something for which there's currently no treatment. I think we need to push really hard to get those final studies done because rapamycin can be found in most hospital pharmacies and it's relatively cheap.
The way you're talking about rapamycin is making it sound a little bit like a sort of panacea for old age and death. Presumably this is part of a suite of pharmacological treatments that people are researching and thinking about in order to deal with ageing.
If it is a panacea, that is because it interferes with a fundamental ageing mechanism or health maintenance mechanism, which is why you're getting diverse effects. It is only the tip of the iceberg of what is coming out of the biology of ageing. There are a whole set of other compounds that seem to have health span promoting effects a bit like rapamycin. And further down the line, research into new ways to block the effects of senescent cells or clear them from the body could potentially allow us to have older people in better health living independently in their own homes, which is what most of us want. I know that's a long way from 1,000-year lifespans, but that's the goal of biogerontology.
Richard Farragher from the University of Brighton on getting old. Now, nobody likes getting an injection, but some people really hate it. Microneedles on a sticking plaster-like patch may be the painless and safe way doctors will test for drugs and infections and give vaccinations in the future. We sent Roland Pease to avoid being pricked by Dr. Ryan Donnelly, Queen's University Belfast.
So what we have here is a patch with 361 individual tiny needles on it. So if you roll up your sleeve, we will apply these microneedles to your skin with gentle pressure and show that it doesn't cause any pain.
And it really feels like almost nothing, just a little roughness.
Well, that's the idea. These microneedles don't go deep enough to contact your nerves and, importantly, your blood vessels as well, so there's also no bleeding associated with this.
I'd heard the sensation described as like Velcro on the skin or a cat's tongue, which seemed close enough. I have to say, the pressure of Ryan Donnelly's thumb was more noticeable than the patch penetrating my skin. Now, the idea of microneedles is not in itself new. What's different about these is what they're made of.
They're actually made out of a very similar material to a soft contact lens. So what this means is that in the dry state, they're hard and sharp enough to penetrate our skin. But whenever they are in the skin, they rapidly take up the fluid from the skin and swell. And that fluid, which we call interstitial fluid, is in balance with your blood. So the concentrations of a medicine in that fluid are very often the same as what they are in the blood. So what we have here is a way of doing blood-free patient monitoring.
So Ryan, what are you hoping to discover with these microneedles in my skin here?
Well, have you had a cup of coffee today?
One or two, yeah.
Okay, so what we'd expect to pick up then would be some caffeine in your skin. Let's have a look at that and see if we can pick it up.
Our walk to the analysis lab took me past a room where a machine, a bit like an ultrasound scanner, but using infrared light, allows Ryan Donnelly and his team to see what's going on under the skin.
So what we see is this white translucent layer, and that's the outermost layer of your skin, Roland, in which all of the barrier properties of your skin reside, even though it's only about 50 microns thick. Here we see the individual microneedles as they pierce this outermost layer of your skin, and we can see them penetrating down into the viable skin layers.
And so those needles are sticking into fluid-rich underlayer of my skin.
Absolutely. So once we cross this outermost thin layer of the skin, the microneedles will suck the fluid up such that we have captured a sample of what's happening in that fluid in your skin and indirectly your blood.
Of course, what comes out can go in as well, and the microneedles Ryan Donnelly and his team are working on aren't just for taking the fluids.
My name is Mwelisa McCrudden, and I'm using the microneedles to actually administer drugs as opposed to sampling fluids from patients. So the entire matrix that makes up these needles has the drug embedded in it, and we find that we can routinely administer various different drugs and we can detect them subsequently in your blood.
So you think already you've shown that this would be an alternative to using a conventional needle?
Yes, exactly, because so many patients are afraid of regular hypodermic needles. So if we can come up with some alternative that's less invasive, doesn't cause them any pain or discomfort, this is exactly what we want to do.
Meanwhile, the patch on my skin had taken up enough fluid for Ryan Donnelly to see what had got into me.
Okay, so what we're going to do now, Roland, is to remove the microneedle patch from your skin and see how much caffeine's in it. So we peel off the patch and put it into a vial of water. We give that a shake, and that will extract the caffeine for analysis.
The patch had become so soft in my skin, there was no danger of anyone becoming scratched or pierced by it now it was used. Important when you realise over 2 million health workers suffer needle stick injuries every year, with the attendant danger of HIV, hepatitis or other infection. Once my extract had been separated and run through the analyser, it was time for the moment of truth.
So how many cups of coffee have you had today?
Two or three.
We can actually see quite a large peak for caffeine, and this is what we would expect from somebody who's had two or three cups of coffee over a relatively short period of time. And that's what we see on the screen here.
About as informative as a test of the Pope's religion, you might think. But actually, caffeine is the compound Ryan Donnelly and his team are using to optimise the microneedle's performance, because it moves through the body, much like many drugs. In the real world, the patches could be used by diabetics to monitor their glucose levels, or for medics to ensure their TB patients keep up with their long courses of antibiotics. But Ryan Donnelly has another pet project he's particularly working on at the moment: premature baby care.
It's crucial to remember that because of their prematurity and the associated complications, these children are on numerous medicines. But because of their vulnerability, we will take a lot of samples to make sure that we're not over or underdosing them. The difficulty with this is they've got very limited volumes of blood. Their bodies are very delicate. We could cause pain, bruising, scarring. Even we could cause anemia by taking too much blood. So we probably don't even monitor enough. Microneedles have the potential to change all that.
And I can imagine a neonate just lying there, so you can press the microneedle patch in quite easily and just leave it until you need to make your measurements.
That would be what we would intend. And from the parents of premature babies we've spoken to, they have been very distressed by the invasive medical procedures that their children have been subjected to, and they were very much in favour of something that could be applied as simply as a sticking plaster and would give the same information.
Ryan Donnelly and his pointless injection system, which, to be blunt, does sound rather good. Now, it's November, and these are the days when you may well have a smouldering bonfire in your back garden, or the carcasses of fallen fireworks clogging your gutters. Marnie Cheston went to meet the Promethean scientists whose lives are devoted to the behaviour of fire.
I'm Dr. Jill Smart. I'm a research fellow here at the Institute for Materials Research and Innovation at the University of Bolton.
I'm Katie Williams. I'm a PhD student studying fire materials here at the University of Bolton.
And we're in a fire lab. What's the point of a fire lab?
We can assess materials and see how easily they burn. It can be anything from fabrics to plastic, composite materials, as would go into an aircraft or a train. So we'll have a go at testing anything.
So basically, you get paid to set fire to stuff. I want to know, is a fire always the same thing? Is there a basic recipe you have for fire?
You need three things: fuel, heat and oxygen, and that will sustain a fire. But no two fires are ever exactly the same, because there's too many environmental factors that can influence it, which means it makes it very difficult for computer modellers to actually model fire behaviour. If you burnt the same building down on two different days, it would behave differently.
Given that we're in a fire lab, do you have anything that you could demonstrate to show the enjoyment of fire? Because I know you're all secretly pyromaniacs. We're through in a different part of the lab, and this reminds me a lot of school science experiments. We've got Bunsen burner, test tube. Katie, what are we doing?
In the test tube, we have some potassium chlorate, which is an oxidising agent, so it's full of oxygen, and I'm just heating it up to melt it down before I start the howling jelly baby reaction, which means I'll be putting a jelly baby in, and people here will be able to see, hopefully, some purple flames from the potassium in the potassium chlorate, and if we're lucky, we'll get a good howling noise out of it.
What's the howling noise?
It's the energy of the reaction, because it's trapped in the test tube. It sort of echoes off the walls of the test tube.
So that potassium, is that one of the colours that they put in fireworks?
Yeah, it makes a sort of, I don't think they use it quite so often, because it makes a very sort of pale lilac colour, which isn't quite as bright on the night sky, especially compared to if they've got magnesium in it, because that's a really bright white.
OK, we've got a jelly baby. We're putting a jelly baby into a test tube. And there are flashes of purple-white light and a small contained fire.
Because it's such a vigorous reaction, we had a bit of flaming jelly baby escape from the top of the test tube and land on some paper towels. But it's all right, because we know what we're doing and we can put it out in a second.
So, Katie, we've just seen lovely lilac light given off there. When people look up at their fireworks, what kind of chemistry are they going to be seeing?
Very bright white light is usually a magnesium-based compound. Bluey-green would be copper. Orangey-red is, I believe, calcium, and then very bright deep red would be strontium. Your sparklers that are very bright white and lots of sparks, that's definitely magnesium in those.
Katie Williams and Jill Smart from the University of Bolton Fire Lab. And of course, do be safe. These women know more about fire than pretty much anyone, so heed their advice.
Whenever you're burning a bonfire, keep a close eye on it, keep a safe distance.
Can I just add something? Be careful what you throw on your bonfire. Make sure that the stuff you throw on will burn and will not explode.
Now, after some tragic setbacks in space exploration in the last couple of weeks, we've got our fingers crossed for Rosetta, which is entering the final countdown before landing on a comet. By this time next week, we will know if the European Space Agency has successfully achieved the impossible.
We have put five decision points where we check specific parameters, and they're all related to the accuracy of the navigation. Are we in the right point? Do we have the right velocity, the right pointing, with the right accuracy? In particular, the last go-no-go decision point will be based about 2 hours before the separation. It will be based on very little information, and we have also very little time, because very soon we have to send an instruction to the spacecraft, yes, you are go for separation or not. Once we've decided to separate, then there's nothing else we can do. Of course, we will be biting our nails and we will be extremely nervous. I consider very important the moment where we pick up the radio signal from the lander during the descent. It is really the main success criteria. If we pick up this signal, no matter what happens on the surface, we will demonstrate that we've landed, we will have pictures during the descent, we will have measurements during the descent. Even if at the touchdown the lander would not survive, we would have had a significant success. You know, this is done for the first time. When you do things, you are allowed to fail, provided you learn why you failed. So this signal is fundamental. If we don't have the signal, then not only the landing will fail, the science will not work, but we will not know why.
Paolo Ferri, head of head of mission operations at the European Space Agency. And Radio 4 has a special programme dedicated to Rosetta's touchdown next Wednesday, the 12th of November at 9 p.m. Finally this week, the curious tale of Dr. Stronzo Bestiali. Dr. Bestiali made his debut in the world of scientific publications in 1987 with authorship of a paper entitled Diffusion in a Periodic Lorentz Gas in the Journal of Statistical Physics. Since then, he's been cited in various other papers and has an online profile that describes him as an active researcher at the Institute of Experimental Physics, University of Vienna. Well done, Dr. Bestiali. Unfortunately, he doesn't exist. In fact, as any of you who know Italian will have spotted, his name is rather rude, certainly unmentionably so on Radio 4. Put it this way, I was on holiday in Rome last week and I saw a moped narrowly miss being flattened by a Fiat Cinquecento. And with appropriate gesticulation, the scooter rider shouted, "Stronzo Bestiali!" at the driver. So, who is the mysterious doctor? Well, the trail stops with a fellow author on that very first paper, American physicist William Hoover. His 1987 study had been initially rejected by two separate scientific journals. Now retired, Professor Hoover didn't wish to talk on air, but here is what he told us.
I was on a flight. Next to me were two Italian women who spoke among themselves. They were constantly saying, "Stronzo Bestiale." This phrase had stuck in my mind. I thought that Stronzo Bestiale would have been the perfect co-author for a refused publication. So I decided to submit my papers again simply by changing the title and adding the name of that author. And the research was published.
Ah, so Stronzo was the joke of a disgruntled physicist. But he is part of a rich history of scientists just mucking around. This type of quixotic and quirky story from the secret annals of science is the domain of the back pages of the weekly magazine New Scientist, who have been tracking phantom scientists for some time.
I'm Mike Holderness, and I'm one of the editors of New Scientist's very popular feedback column.
So, Mike, we've heard of Dr. Stronzo Bestiali, but are there others? Are there other fictional authors that have popped up in your pages?
Oh, there are many. One of my favourites, and certainly the one most often featured, is Cleo Boisoi, who has, for example, submitted a paper entitled Aquadog, Use of Trained Border Collies to Herd Fish and Protect Them in Vulnerable Marine Aquaculture Facilities. This was submitted to the third annual World Congress of Aquaculture and Fisheries, which took place in Dalian, China. The message accepting the paper and invoicing for the very significant fee for attending this not very prominent conference arrived the day after Cleo passed away. Philip Clapham, who's a literary executor, notes that the only stupider thing than a conference accepting a ridiculous paper authored by a dog is a conference accepting a ridiculous paper authored by a dead dog.
Hold on a sec. I mean, that sounds like quite a credible conference. Is this not a serious business?
One of the phenomena of being a scientist in the age of the internet is getting invitations to conferences which appear, in many cases, the lawyers will probably allow us to say, to exist mainly to collect fees.
So playful scientists are using these fake authorship studies, fake authorship conference presentations in order to expose these scams? Or
it's a very efficient way of detecting one of these scams, is to submit a randomly generated abstract and see what happens to it.
And did we ever find out who Cleo Borzoi actually was?
Cleo was a border collie living in, if I remember rightly, British Columbia.
Owned by someone who...
Philip Clapham, who is a researcher with a sideline in exposing fake conferences.
Outstanding. So these phantom authors and these made-up fictional scientists, they aren't just jokes. They aren't just scientists taking the mick out of the process, are they?
There are a number of other reasons for using pseudonyms or playing with authorship in general. I think most researchers in all fields are annoyed by research impact assessments and the bureaucratic paperwork to get their departmental funding. And a scholar in the humanities will write an essay about how unjust and unfair and illegitimate these are. A statistician will query the methodology. And a mathematician or someone in the mathematical sciences will poke the system to see what happens. I think possibly CERN, with its proliferating authorship, it may be doing that. Feedback readers have alerted us to one paper that has 3,213 authors, originating from the large tunnel underneath Geneva.
With papers that have more than 3,000 authors, like this one from CERN, what does it say about the way science is being reported, the way science is actually being conducted? Because there's no way that all of those authors actually wrote that paper.
No, they didn't. Obviously, what CERN is doing is they have a very large spreadsheet of everybody's contributed. One of my colleagues was working on the technical side at CERN and was regularly credited for having helped design part of the accelerator. It's clearly can be a problem when people sign up as authors to papers that they haven't read. There have been a number of cases of papers that have been retracted where it turned out that somebody's supervisor or their professor or both insisted on being credited as authors to get some of the research impact assessment goodness out of the paper, to get some points credited to their own CV, and then discovered that they'd signed up to a paper which was incorrect.
Give us some examples of that, of papers that have had multiple authorship which have turned out to be fraudulent.
I think some of the retracted papers, and they're not shown to be fraudulent, concerning what appeared to be very exciting findings in stem cell generation, it turned out that, and it was sort of widely accepted with a shrug that senior people had signed up as authors without necessarily checking out every detail.
Phantom, non-existent scientist authors are used to ridicule the system, but often it's just scientists having a laugh, isn't it?
Yes, and playing with their sense of symmetry and completeness and the membership of sets. One was a set of two authors, George Gamow and Ralph Alpha, who published a paper in 1948 which predicted the cosmic microwave background. And they looked at their names and asked their colleague Hans Bethe to sign up to be an author to the paper purely so that the author list would read Alpha, Beta, Gamma.
I think that's brilliant. I love those guys.
Mike Holderness from New Scientist. Do send us your imaginary scientists, BBC Inside Science at bbc.co.uk. That's all for now. See you next week.